Hello all, welcome to the God Said Was podcast. This is Patrick Barney. I'm one of the editors of Kai Drakonis Books. Kai Drakonis Books is an independent anarchist press dedicated to publishing socially engaged literature. With me, as always, are the other two editors of Kai Drakonis Books, and that is Chris Malmberg and Hans Berger, both of whom are esteemed throughout the world for their trenchant wit and keen minds. And today we are going to talk about something that's kind of like not usual for this podcast. Well, I don't know if it's not usual, but we're going to talk about Michael Crichton's Sphere. We don't typically talk about like authors with huge names like Michael Crichton who are like widely popular, is I suppose what I meant. But yeah, we're going to talk about Sphere by Michael Crichton. And it was H. Berg's pick. So it's up to you, H. Berg.
All right, cool. Well, I guess I should start by doing a brief synopsis for anybody who hasn't read it or hasn't read it recently. And I guess most of the time we do books on the podcast where like plot points aren't a major draw, so spoilers aren't so much of an issue. But obviously, you know, if you haven't read the book, it relies for its effect on plot-based suspense more so than a lot of what we probably talk about. So, you know, stop listening if you haven't read it already. But just a brief synopsis. Sphere is about a group of scientists who are sent to investigate a spacecraft that seems to have crashed in the ocean floor thousands of years ago. And as they investigate the spacecraft, they determine that it is a human-created spacecraft that traveled back in time through a black hole and materialized on the ocean floor rather than crashing, and find an object inside it that it seems to have gathered either from another dimension or somewhere in space, which is a large sphere, a very large metal sphere, a perfectly made sphere. And most of the book follows three characters in particular: Norman, a psychologist, Beth, a marine biologist, and Harry, who is a mathematician. And they initially begin talking to what they believe to be an alien intelligence named Jerry, who was locked inside the sphere. And Jerry becomes hostile and kind of irrational. And then they're attacked by a giant squid. Their underwater habitat is partially destroyed by a giant squid, and a number of the people who are participating in the expedition die. And through a certain amount of investigation, Norman, the psychologist, eventually figures out that the character of Jerry, the supposed alien intelligence, and the squid, and some other phenomenon that they're encountering are the result of the mathematician Harry's subconscious being physically manifested after he went into the sphere, right? So the power of the sphere is that it gives your... the power of the sphere is that when you come out of the sphere, your thoughts are given physical manifestation, whether those are your conscious deliberate thoughts or things in your subconscious, right? So the presumably Harry doesn't know that he is doing this. Jerry, the supposed alien, and the giant squid are unintentional manifestations from Harry's subconscious. Through various events, more and more conflict and tension develops between Beth and Norman and Harry, culminating eventually in Norman going into the sphere and discovering also that Beth has gone into the sphere. And so the three of them, each with their respective powers, understanding the danger of the existence of the sphere and of, you know, their own uncontrollable psyches being physically manifested, collectively decide to will the sphere out of existence using their own power. So they escape from the underwater location and they each agree to make the sphere go away and their own power with it. And then there is one sentence at the very end suggesting that Beth did not, in fact, participate and that she has retained the power in spite of the good faith efforts by Harry and Norman to get rid of the sphere and get rid of the power that it's given them. So I read this as an adolescent, as I suspect many people do, right? And I read it in my very early 20s, maybe 2021-ish. And then I really hadn't read it since then. And I had a memory of it as being the closest that Crichton had ever got to doing something that was, if not literary, at least kind of thoughtful and thematically complex in a way that none of his other stuff really is. And when I was introducing the book in the end of the last podcast, I referred to Solaris by Stanislaw Lem and Roadside Picnic by the... Oh, gosh, what are those guys' names? The Strugatsky brothers, yeah. And also, I think the filmic adaptations of those books, right, which are thematically somewhat similar and I think just as thematically rich textually as the books, right? I had kind of referenced those as points of comparison in the sense that they all three deal with an alien artifact that grants or may grant the power to give some kind of physical manifestation to your fears or dreams or wishes, right? And that power is rendered dangerous by the unknowability and uncontrollability of the human psyche and by the fundamental inability for the humans and the aliens to understand each other, or for the artifacts of the aliens to really understand the humans and vice versa, right? So the fundamental kind of inexplicability both of the self and the other, right? So that's kind of a thematic similarity between all those works. Oddly enough, even, I mean, the planet Solaris is a sphere, and in the book Roadside Picnic, the mystical object that grants wishes is a golden sphere, right? So there's even a kind of basic overlap there. So my question for you guys was, granting that, you know, differing levels of familiarity with Solaris and Roadside Picnic, like just based on your understanding of those works, the films and the books, how does sphere function similarly to those other works, and how does it approach those ideas differently, right? And are these works aiming at similar effects, or are they using goals and techniques that are fundamentally different?
I think that as far as Solaris and Sphere are concerned, they do share like the basic premise of the encounter with the other, where the unknowability of the other kind of leads to, you know, these problems that the characters face. But while I would say Sphere maybe somewhat optimistic that the unconscious can be contained or controlled, Solaris seems like it ends with maybe... I don't think that Solaris actually ends on a pessimistic note. I actually think it's interesting how they seem to... The characters Kelvin and Snout seem to find some sense of meaning in like this new theory about the sphere, the planet's infancy that they come up with. But ultimately, I think the novel suggests that the unknowability reigns, yeah. right? Whereas as a sphere seems like it is more willing to be optimistic about humans' ability to control their inner thoughts and feelings. To be honest, like Roadside Picnic, Roadside Picnic, I found to be a very big conundrum for me. Like, I didn't see any of these things that you're talking about in it. Like, yeah, the Golden Sphere exists, but it, like, to me, it seemed like just like a side story. Like, I don't know. Like, maybe you can talk more about Roadside Picnic and what you thought. But definitely a similarity between Sphere and Solaris, 100%.
I didn't have an opportunity to read Solaris, and I've never read it, and I didn't reread Roadside Picnic. But Hans, at the end of Roadside Picnic, doesn't the POV character sort of decide to wish for something kind of selfless?
Yeah.
That's what's ringing in my head.
He does. Yeah, he does. Yeah, definitely. I mean, he basically just wishes for happiness for everyone.
Right. But of course, that's right where it ends, so you don't really know.
Right. And I mean, I know that, and boy, I'm going to do the unprofessional thing here of periodically mixing up plot lines and points from these books and movies and, you know. I know that in Stalker, one thing that they talk about in the film that was adapted from Roadside Picnic, there's, I think, more concern expressed about the fear of having a wish granted that you don't want to admit to, right?
Mm-hmm.
Seeing something, you going in and you know, you that people find the, in the film it's a room, right? People find the room that grants their wishes, and then they commit suicide because they are stunned to discover what it is that they actually wished for, right? And so
sure.
I think that's maybe one area where, you know, if you want to think about the idea of unknowability in all these texts, right? It's partly the unknowability of the other, and it's partly the unknowability of the self that generates the mystery or the sense of uncertainty or danger. And thinking about it now, I think that, like, and this isn't really connected to Sphere, so maybe I'm getting off topic here, but it just struck me that, like, Roadside Picnic seems to be very much about the unknowability of the other, right? It's fundamentally about the unknowability of the aliens who came and left these artifacts and left. And we don't know why, and we'll never know why. We don't know what the purpose of the artifacts is, and we'll never know why, right? There's like a deep abiding gulf between us and this alien other. Whereas in Stalker, I think because of that preoccupation with the fear of what one will find when one sees one's wishes granted, right? There's more of an interest there in the unknowability of oneself, right? And I think that's generally kind of a bucket that you could put these different works into, right? Is, are they more interested in the unknowability of oneself as a danger, or are they more interested in the true alienness of the alien as a danger, right? So, like, Solaris, I think, even though, like, the tagline for Solaris, like, my copy here on the back, it says, like, Solaris asks the question, can we understand the universe around us without first understanding what lies within, right? Having just reread Solaris, I'm not necessarily convinced that it is so much interested in that question, right? like the unknowability of the planet Solaris is much more of interest, right? And it's not necessarily,
Yeah,
you know, the fact that the planet manifests somebody's dead ex-girlfriend that they have deep-seated guilt feelings over, that's not surprising, right? And it's not like he needs to come to some kind of terms with his understanding of himself to move forward, either plot-wise or character-wise. So I think that, like, that idea, that interpretive idea of Solaris as being about, like, the unknowability of oneself as an issue to understanding the other, I don't know if I get that either from the book or the movie, right?
Which movie?
Either one.
Is there a kind of like zeitgeist element to this, where like the 60s, 70s, when Roadside Solaris the book came out in the 60s, yeah, and I think Roadside Picnic came out in the early mid 70s, and then Stalker came out almost in, or like right in the early 1980s or something, and then Sphere came out in the 1980s. Is there a kind of a zeitgeist thing where where fear of the unknowability of the other is more evident in the earlier works, and then the way we kind of think about it now is sort of, we almost like want to translate that into like a knowability of self, or is that just like me kind of projecting onto it?
Well,
adaptations even kind of like shift that sort of, you know, like the lack of control over your own mind manifesting things. And that's something that is just a more modern thing.
Well, I mean, I'm just like wildly connecting two things, but like, Sphere was published in 87?
Yeah.
Okay. So that makes all three of them, granted Sphere at the end of, but all three of them published during the Cold War, right? Where, you know, the East and the West were probably, like, to the East, the West is a giant, decadent, scary other, and to the West, the East is a giant, austere, scary other, right?
Yeah.
So that at least makes sense for the two European books that we're talking about, Solaris and Roadside Picnic, that the alien other is of more interest and of more is the eye of the novels are directed more at that other than the inner other of the self. Now I don't know exactly how Sphere fits in there, but I enjoyed reading Sphere. Like, I didn't, you know, it wasn't like the, like a, like, it didn't blow my mind like it blew yours at 12, right, Hans?
Right.
But it was certainly interesting, and there was definitely some complex questions that I thought of, and I thought like I was definitely uncomfortable with how like the novel psychologizes Harry as a black man, talking about like his paranoia and whatnot. And it's funny because I used to read this daily here in Cincinnati called City Beat, a real lefty publication. And they had a columnist named Kathy Wilson who talked about black experience. And she, you know, specifically used that phrase, black paranoia, at one point in one of her columns. And I was fine with it because she's black, you know, talking about black experience. But I felt a little weirder having a white writer tell us about black paranoia, you know? Even if I feel weird about that, all this being said, the novel does at least try to, like, you know, it does seem to like be looking at the other in a interested in understanding why we're afraid of the other. Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely. Chris, I just wanted to, Patrick said something that I wanted to see if you agreed with, right? Patrick, a while ago you said that you felt that Sphere was optimistic about the ability of the mind to be controlled and channeled, right? And I was curious, Chris, if you agree with that?
I think I don't, but... Sorry, Patrick, you're alone on this. But I think there is. So I'll say, like, it's interesting that I think that Sphere is the most sort of popular. Like, it's written to be ingested and experienced and enjoyed by a wide group of people, a broad group of people. And I feel like for that reasons, it's just a little bit simpler in ways than Roadside Picnic. And I said, I haven't read Solaris, but
Sphere is much simpler than Solaris. Yeah.
Just
to confirm that it is a much, like I couldn't have read Solaris as a 12-year-old and enjoyed it at all.
Yeah. I actually haven't seen the original, which is terrible because I love, that's Tarkovsky, right? I love his work, but the original film adaptation that is, but
it's crazy good.
Yeah, I imagine.
I mean, I have mixed feelings about it because it doesn't represent the book, but it's a great film.
Well, I feel like Sphere is one of the more ambiguous Crichton books, and maybe the most ambiguous. I've read a few of them when I was younger, like Hans, and it's definitely been a while. But there is a kind of a thing where at the end, I think we're invited to sort of ask questions about what's really going on, whether or not Beth has agreed. It's hinted because her beauty is potentially tied to her power. And at the end, after they've all sort of agreed and supposedly dropped their power, we're sort of trapped in the psychologist's viewpoint. And he notices how beautiful she looks and comments on it. And she gives a kind of a knowing sort of smile. I think there are other aspects of Sphere that are kind of potentially ambiguous that, while not very complicated, make it feel not necessarily optimistic about our ability to sort of control our subconscious. I think it's pretty pessimistic about our ability to control our subconscious, but maybe of more complicated sort of like exploration of like how much that actually matters. If Beth doesn't drop the power at the end, but the spacecraft still travels into an alternate dimension or the future or whatever to get the sphere in return, then a lot of the concern that is sort of like consuming the three of them at the end of the novel, and they're given time to think about the ramifications of unleashing the power on the world, they didn't bear fruit in the same way. Like, life did continue, and maybe it continued in a weird way, but it still continued. And maybe I'm kind of going far afield here, but I don't think it's necessarily as simple as being pessimistic or optimistic about the subconscious so much as actually kind of being maybe a little bit simplistic about the manifestation of the subconscious. I think that that's, one of the harder things that the novel has to pull off, where, Harry is afraid of squids. So a squid appears,
Which is actually not unconscious at all. Like, he's conscious that he's afraid of squids.
Well, I mean, but his, yeah, I guess, like, it's hinted that his subconscious mind might be consumed about with a phobia, and maybe it is because they're underwater. I don't know. There's things there that I feel a little bit simplistic. I think it's
well, I definitely agree with that. Yeah.
Yeah. It feels like it's pretty clear that given power in Sphere, that the characters would struggle to sort of like rein that power in. But then as far as concern about like the US, you know, sort of like gathering another weapon and, you know, like adding another weapon to their arsenal and everything like that, all of those are actually they're sort of naive concerns, right? Because like, that's basically what humans do, is they just like add to our power set. We fret and we like wring our hands about like the ramifications of this thing unleashed on Earth, and then, you know, life continues. Maybe not better, you know, but like, I don't know if this is answering your question, Hans, but I say that it doesn't come down as like humans being in control of their subconscious, but I wondered about like its ultimate sort of judgment about what that means.
That's a very interesting question, actually. You know, you guys, you Patrick, you mentioned a Cold War framing for this. I know that Crichton, this doesn't at all have to do with the Cold War, but just in terms of thinking about interests and context around this time, he, in the period leading up to the publication of Sphere, he was actually very interested in New Age phenomena, psychics, channeling, auras, meditation. He had kind of an ambiguous interest in a lot of that. He participated in a lot of it. He experimented with a lot of it. He wasn't, his position was that he didn't buy into the kind of theoretical systems that were built up to explain things like psychic visions or auras, but his own experience suggested that they did exist as phenomena, that there were, he believed that there were energies of the body that were, energies of the body that were expressed and understood as things like chakras or kind of mystical energy that, that we don't, basically that did exist scientifically and that would in the future be investigated and documented in a scientific manner, right? He compared it to like, if you think about like chiropractors, right? Like if you look at if you look at the underlying quote unquote, I don't know if science is even the word for it, right? But chiropractors in some sense believe a lot of horse shit, right? But fundamentally it still works, right?
What do they believe?
Oh, I don't remember, but the kind of underlying theory of chiropractic work is very odd if you dig into it, right? But I mean, chiropractors still achieve results, right? Or like acupuncture, right? Like you don't have to believe in the underlying theories that you don't have to believe in the theories that underpin acupuncture to recognize that it achieves measurable results in certain contexts, right? And that was Crichton's feeling about things like, you know, psychic chakras and psychics and that sort of thing. That it seems to me like if the question is, what are the stakes of understanding the, if the question is, what are the stakes of understanding and controlling the subconscious? I guess it's extra textual to say that he did believe there were ways the subconscious or the unconscious could manifest beyond simply, you know, outward action, right? But that is something that he believed. I don't know that there is a textual answer to how much does it matter, right? I mean, I think your point, Chris, that like the fact that the spaceship is still launched in the future means that Beth does not become some kind of god and just, you know, single-handedly rule the world. That's probably true, right? She probably just has, she looks really good and she has a good career and everybody loves her, and then she ages and dies normally, most likely, right? But that is an interesting point, right? I think that it creates, like, the device of the plot creates a situation where control and understanding of the unconscious are of paramount importance, right? It creates a situation where those stakes are heightened. I don't know if it has an answer about the importance of those in a normal situation.
Well, so let's say life does go on. Let's say she keeps the power, but life goes on as normal, which would be indicated by the fact that the spaceship goes on into the future and no one has heard of the sphere. That would indicate that, to some extent, Beth would have had to have harnessed the power in some way so that it didn't do, like, massive damage.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah,
so
that's
true.
Right.
She used it, which would go back to my point that the book is optimistic that we can control it.
All right. I think we walked into that one, Patrick.
I mean, right?
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, it's not a competition. Nobody has to win. I just wonder.
Are Harry and it's Norman, right?
I listened to Norman.
Harry and Norman, are they foolish at the end? Because, like, they're too close to the problem, kind of thing. Like, oh, this is scary. You know, they could wish away the sphere and keep the power for themselves.
Sure.
Which is basically what Beth does. And, like, why, like, in the end, I kind of, even though I feel like Beth's characterization has some problems, I ended up feeling kind of, I admired her for her, you know, she, in the end, you know, she's the one who holds the cards. If she keeps the power, and I think it's pretty strongly hinted that she does, but, like, I felt in the end, like I was, and I don't know if this is something Crichton would intend, you know, this is, it's very prudent. It's very, you know, like, almost prudent to a fault, though. Norman is, like, you know, prudent to a fault at the end, potentially. And then Beth seizes the day, seizes the future, seizes this thing that, like, has, like, landed in front of her. And it's kind of fucking stupid that, you know, I think it's interesting that we're kind of invited to see that as, like, this sort of overcorrection of a woman who has been sort of oppressed by the patriarchy. And so we kind of, like, see her do that. And we're like, oh yes, it's like Eve, you know, she's seizing the apple or whatever.
I mean, she definitely deserves to, like, not be fucked over by, like,
oh yeah,
Harry, who, what did Harry do? He, like, laughed at the fact that her lover / grad professor stole all her work.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know. And, it's really awful.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, I mean, I definitely root for Beth. If, you know, she kept the power and used it to, like, get ahead. Okay. I mean,
yeah,
that seems reasonable.
I guess. Yeah. This is a question of, like, maybe authorial intent mixed with, like, how our reading of the book might change with time. Right. But Norman at the end is a little bit of a pansy, right? Like, they're safe. They have the power, you know, like, he's afraid of his own self-conscious and Harry's afraid of his own self-conscious and Beth isn't, you know, that's
for,
like,
sure.
I don't know. That's,
I see what,
maybe
you're
my own reading.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
They're terrified of their self-conscious. So they are like, we got to get rid of this. Whereas Beth is like, I got power.
I think, well, and there's more to be said about Beth too, I think, as a character, right? And one of the questions I had sent you guys was about the extent to which, basically just, like, how bothered are we by the characterization of Beth, the behavior of Beth, the way that other people think and talk about Beth, right? The point that I made in the question was that the way that Beth, like, just, you know, I'm less bothered by Beth's actions and speech and behavior, right? Like, just the way she is crafted as a character bothers me less than the reactions that other people have to her, that Norman's narration and some of Harry's comments, right? That, I mean, I think that, like, I think she is an interesting and complex character, right? And probably the most complex character in the novel, maybe the only complex character in the novel, right? She has these kind of competing impulses of kindness and nurturing and a certain kind of viciousness, and, you know, she can be very manipulative, and there's probably ways in which some of those impulses are kind of like, if she goes into the sphere and has the power, then her worst impulses are put into a feedback loop, right? And I think, I mean, she kind of breaks down to some extent, but that seems understandable to me under the circumstances, right? So, like, as a work of characterization, I don't know that I was too bothered by her, right? But there's something about Harry's, Harry is really quite, you know, by contemporary standards, like, horribly mean-spirited and unsympathetic about a way in which she's genuinely been abused and preyed on, right? And Harry is someone who is generally a fairly rational, clear-headed individual, an asshole, but not necessarily a malevolent asshole, right? And so I know that there, I have the, boy, it's funny, like, I had the rough sense ahead of time that there were people who were troubled by the way that Beth works and is used in the novel, and that it's regarded as sexist in that way. But then, and when I read it, I was pretty uncomfortable with some of how Beth is kind of thought about and talked about. But then I tried to find writing about sexism in Sphere, and the only thing I found was a female critic saying that she admired Beth standing up for herself throughout the story. The exact quote was, "Beth is a strong, independent female that I really admired. She's not afraid to stand up for herself, and she makes many remarks to her teammates about treating women with respect. It was refreshing to read from such a feminist perspective," which was fascinating to me because it was so different from how I was construing the portrayal of that character. So I don't know that I'm putting this into a great, I'm not wrapping all these thoughts up into, like, a great little ball of question here, you know, but, like, how did you guys feel about the portrayal of Beth, the way that the narrative voice talked about Beth? How much is the sexism of Harry and Norman being critiqued versus endorsed? Is Norman sexist?
To answer that question, I want to know. So remember when Norman, like, sees her naked and she's, like, moving her body seductively at him?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Towards the end of the novel, is that Beth's power from the sphere or Norman's?
Norman hasn't been in the sphere at that point.
Okay, he hadn't been in the sphere at that point. So this is what to answer your question, Hans. I wonder, you know, if Beth is manifesting this, what does that mean? Is that, like, if Beth is manifesting, like, seductivity, and that's something that she is afraid of and can't control, I don't know. That seems a little problematic.
I think that, like, the novel, it's weird. This is, like, the kind of thing that, you know, in grad school that, like, it's probably, you know, this is how you get tenure by inventing just really, like, off the wall ways of reading stuff and that isn't really supported by the text. Sure. But Norman is talking about how the fixations or, like, the mental infrastructure, psychological infrastructure of the people around him shapes how they see and experience things and how they, you know, what they think is actually happening. And then also when they're given the power, how they react to that or seek to kind of control it or whatever. And so this book being told, you know, through him is interesting because it basically positions all of the irrational, seemingly irrational things that the characters around him are doing in a sort of a psychological context, right? So, like, there's some sort of subconscious reason why Harry is sort of, you know, vindictive or you know, acerbic or whatever, and then, or why Ted is just sort of needs validation. And then why, you know, a subconscious reason why Beth is sort of manifesting these sexual powers, because, you know, and that might or might not be true, but it seems like it, you know, you could sort of twist the book to say that a lot of what we see, even though it's not first person, but, like, because Norman is the viewpoint character, it is sort of suspect. And this is kind of why I think about, like, Crichton, you know, in general being a little bit more buttoned up in his storytelling. You know, I feel like in the end we are somewhat invited to kind of, like, we're not in Beth's head, and Beth is saying things that, you know, she's planting bombs. She's, when Norman watches the video that shows her going into the sphere, she reacts very aggressively, you know, and we're kind of invited to wonder how much, you know, sort of self-awareness she has in that moment, because we're in Norman's head a little bit, and because, like, we're kind of taught by Norman to look at what the other characters are doing as being driven by subconscious, which is, like, his whole argument. He argues that, like, everyone ignores the, you know, the power of the subconscious, and that he's the only one who really appreciates how important it is. And then that becomes, like, the elevated reason for why everyone is sort of acting the way they're acting. And I don't know that there's too much of a substrate there to grow, like, an article that'll give me tenure, but, like, we're not in Beth's head as much as Norman would like to think he's in Beth's head. And that's an interesting sort of wrinkle in her behavior. And I think I was sort of primed, actually, even while reading it, to kind of read her as a poorly portrayed character. And now I'm kind of wondering whether or not that was unfair because of how much I was sort of granting Norman and his sort of, like, you know, I don't know if he's sexist, but he is deeply skeptical and cynical about individual humans' abilities to, you know, be rational. And he's just inclined to see irrationality. And for a woman who has experienced prejudice against her sex in academia, that becomes basically the schema that, you know, organizes all of how he sees her. And so I don't know if that, I think I read, I did have a problem with her while I was reading it, and now I'm thinking about it, and I wonder if I should rethink that.
There's a sequence that struck me in regards to this question toward the end of the novel, there's something that happens where the underwater lab is just kind of, there's this thing that comes toward it that's just kind of this like swirling, amorphous, shapeless kind of cloud, right? And Norman's reading of it is that Beth is terrified of her own power, right? That she is, because she is so used to framing herself in a role of victimhood, she has become scared of her own power, and that the thing that is manifesting and threatening them is Beth's power as an individual. But that is, there's no, that's not like something like a squid where it can take a clear, direct shape, right? It's just kind of this vague thing. And that was, when I talk about like being, when I talk about being uncomfortable with the portrayal of Beth, that's an instance of the kind of thing that I mean, right? Where like, it's fair, I think, for her to be, it's fair for her to be genuinely hurt by the experience that she had. And there's just a certain kind of, the way that Norman makes sense of that, there's something troublesome about it, where there's just a kind of like, maybe judgmentalism about it, for lack of a better word, or there's a kind of disempathy that he has toward her habits of mind that seems, that struck me as unfair on a first read. But it is also true that like, I mean, it's a big swirling amorphous cloud, right? It's shapeless and formless and meaningless by definition. So Norman's viewpoint of it, Norman's reading of it, isn't necessarily, that is like, that's a Rorschach for him too, right? Like that's him.
Sure.
So, you know, there's potentially just as much about him in his reading of that as there is about Beth. And I'm not sure that, I mean, from my general sense of Crichton, I'm not sure that he would want us to read that moment as undercutting Norman or as being ambiguous. But I think that it's hard not to when you make the point that you do, Chris. So that's an interesting perspective. And that was one of the questions that I had asked, right, was that Norman has kind of a lot of climactic moments of awareness, right? And he, very near the end of the novel, he almost runs away from Harry and Beth and leaves them to die, and then has a moment of realizing, no, I am avoiding my own feelings of fear. I need to go back and save these people, right? And I wondered if there are, like, he's generally the most rational, clear-eyed character. Are there other times that you see as, is he as consistently reasonable and logical as a surface reading would suggest? Or are there any other ways that you can read the text to undercut his character and his action? I guess this is a relatively, because this is something that's written for a mass audience, because this is something that you're a smart 12-year-old can appreciate, there's not necessarily a lot of room for ambiguity and interpretation here in matters like that, is there?
Yeah, I can't think of anything other than the fact that, like, if some people were like, hey, we got to go to this crash site, it's in the middle of the fucking ocean, I'd be like, no, like, go find someone Go find an island person to be who's closer, an island psychologist. I mean, I don't know.
I mean, the only example that I can think of is the example that we just talked about, where his reading of Beth's actions is probably too pat or too simple or not nuanced enough. You know, that seems to undermine him as a reasonable character, but otherwise, yes, he seems rational and the most reasonable character, and I don't know exactly why. I don't know what other textual evidence there is that undermines that, if there is any.
All right, fair enough. I guess that's...
If you were...
Oh, no, go ahead, Chris. If you were...
I was going to interrupt with a stupid question, so please go on.
Yeah, I could tell, like, I could hear in your tone that it was going to be a stupid question, so I thought I'd let you get it out of your system briefly, and then I could say the thing I was going to say.
If you were in this, if you entered the sphere and came out, what would be the subconscious things that would haunt you or the people around you?
Oh, geez. Solitude, I guess. Involuntary solitude.
I'll tell you mine. Everyone would get sick and start dying of terrible diseases. It would be real bad.
Well, it's interesting, right? Because, like, be I guess awful. The question is, one thing that is, because of, like, the way that the plot is structured and because of the, like, the mechanics of what people are actually like when they come out of the sphere and have the power, like what the limits of the power are, what the operations of the power are, you know, those are...
I want to know more about that.
I think that, like, as a writer, it poses a lot of problems, right? Like, you can kind of tell that,
yeah.
Crichton is, to some extent, he's structuring the novel, he's cleverly structured the novel to avoid too many kind of mechanical questions of what the real actions, like, if somebody just spent 10 years having the power, what the fuck would that be like, right? Or, like, you know, when Beth goes and lays explosives around the submarine, or around the spaceship and the habitat, why doesn't she just think the explosives there, right? Or, like, when Norman is trying to deactivate the explosives, he thinks them into being deactivated. Why doesn't he just think them into not existing, you know? And I mean, I think,
and when they,
it's easy in the moment to, like, be okay with the fact that these characters are in a stressful situation. It's a new thing. They're not necessarily thinking through all the ramifications of what they can do, right?
Right.
But
I want to know, at the end of the novel, they come up to the surface. Why don't they, like, think about feeding all the starving people in the world and getting everybody access to medicine? Why don't they just think about that?
Well, I think for the same reason, right? Because they don't really understand the mechanics of what the power can do, and they're not sure. You know, like, you brought up the question, Chris, of, like, if you went into the sphere, what would your subconscious fear be, right? And it's like, if you think about, if your subconscious fear is, you know, if for you it's hypochondria, right? Does that manifest as everybody getting sick of weird, mysterious diseases? Or does that manifest as you first choosing to think everyone into health because that is a matter of the most concern to you, right? And you can see, I think, there are parts of the novel where it operates the one way and parts of the novel where it operates the other, right? So, you know, if my fear is solitude, does that express by me, like, being mysteriously alone all the time because I'm manifesting this preoccupation, or does that manifest as me making up a bunch of, like, you know, people to be around me all the time, right? It's I don't know that there's a textual answer, right? But because the power really only occurs in the last part of the novel in this kind of high stress situation, he kind of worms his way out of considering those mechanics.
But it's also a problem because, like, it seems like the power seems to both manifest unconscious things, but also be able to perform the conscious wishes of the people who have it. So, like, you know, like they will themselves to forget, and they do. That's a conscious action. So what is the power? Like, that seems problematic from a craft standpoint. Like, just what you're saying, problematic in that, you know, there are probably a lot of ramifications of the power that Crichton is avoiding in the novel. Right.
If this novel were written today, does the focus shift from fear of self and subconscious in some way to some other fear of like, has the zeitgeist changed since the 80s enough for this power to manifest as a different sort of challenge or threat to the characters if the novel were written today?
Fear of self doesn't seem to be the dominant zeitgeist in today. Does it?
I don't think it does, no. I suppose it depends on who would be writing the novel, right? I'm not sure that I would look at any period in history and say, oh, that's a period when fear of self was the dominant zeitgeist, right? It's almost always the fear of some sort of an other, right? And there might be greater or lesser amounts of fear of self kind of wrapped up in that. But I'm sure that, like, obviously, you know, the politics of the novel would be very different if it were written today.
Sure.
And it might be more consciously. I mean, I think that, like, a lot of what bothers us about the politics of the novel kind of come from the attempt to perceive from an apolitical space things which aren't actually possible to perceive from an apolitical space, right? Like, there's a way in which, like, Norman and maybe Crichton through Norman think that they can kind of perceive Beth's gender conflict ideas without being directly involved in them, or to an extent of detachment, right? That, like, I don't think people would be allowed to maintain in if the novel were written today. Or, you know, the ways in which, like, Harry's race paranoia is
right.
I mean, I think, like, the implication is that Harry participates in race paranoia and the white guys don't, right? And I don't think that that's a thing. Nobody would express that idea today, I don't think. Or, I mean, right. Nobody would express that idea in something that got published and got attention.
Well, is that it?
I have one last question for you, Patrick, and this is just a sheer, this is like candy question. This is just, you know, for my own entertainment. But I'm deeply curious, right? And I put this in the questions that I wrote, and I might just kind of read this one verbatim, right? But, like, I'm very interested in how you reacted to this as someone who came to it with, you know, you have a lot of exposure to the kind of tropes that this deals with. You have exposure to, like, other versions of this story, right? Like, it's very, it's very hard for me to perceive this work objectively because I encountered it when I was 12, right? And it was the first, to the extent that you can think of this as philosophical sci-fi, this was the first philosophical sci-fi that I ran into, right? And I had nothing to prepare me for any of the plot points, and it was all deeply mind-blowing, right? And coming to it now, I recognize that there are a lot of things in it that, like, you know, like the plot is the plot of Forbidden Planet to a great extent, right? Or like there are kind of obvious parallels in Solaris and maybe less so Roadside Picnic. But I mean, I'm sure Crichton knew Solaris, you know, when he wrote this. Or, you know, there's a Jack London story about tribesmen who worship a giant alien sphere, right? So there are precursors to this I was not aware of, right? So I just, how much suspense did you experience reading this, and how much of it was just like, oh, okay, cool, it's Forbidden Planet, whatever?
I mean, I'd seen the movie.
Oh, you had? And... Oh, I didn't know that. Oh, that's too bad.
Yeah, yeah, I've seen the movie.
Oh,
so
terrible movie.
Not a good movie, but like the plot of the film and the plot of the novel are at least parallel enough that like I knew that they would give up the power at the end, although the end of the movie is not ambiguous about death, right? It's like a happy ending. They've given up, right?
Yeah.
They've given up the power. Not that Beth not giving up the power isn't a happy ending, but so I wasn't super surprised by anything. Reasonably entertaining story, barring all the, you know, the stuff that might be sexist or racist, you know, that, you know, that's, you know, going to be negatives for me, you know.
Right. But somewhat inevitable in 35-year-old sci-fi.
Right, yeah. You read, you know, I'm sure if we looked at Solaris, we'd see something sexist, you know, if we talked about it more deeply. Though not as obvious, because I did just read it and I don't remember anything as obviously sexist.
Right.
But you know, reasonable book as a story, definitely I would say more thought-provoking than, like, you know, not in any way it's not a shallow book. You know, you can, definitely makes you think. So, certainly successful on that level.
Kind of like Beans, which make you stink.
Right, exactly. Beans make you stink, and that's always successful.
Right. Very good. Well, what's the next podcast about?
Okay, I'm gonna butcher this person's name, but I wanna read The Sympathizer by Viet Thanh Nguyen. I think is how you say his name, I believe. Viet Thanh Nguyen. And it's about a Vietnamese man who serves as a secretary for a general of the South Vietnamese forces at the end of the Vietnam War. And when the South Vietnamese forces lose the war, he and the general and some others flee to the United States. But there's a catch. The secretary, who is the narrator of the novel, is a mole for the Viet Cong, baby. So he's a spy. And I've started to listen to it, and it is super, super interesting. So
what's the name of it again?
The Sympathizer. Viet Thanh, Thanh Nguyen, Nguyen.
Very cool. Sounds good.
Yeah, it looks super cool. It won like the Man Booker Prize, I think. So, you know, I'm not saying that means anything, but maybe it means something. So, yeah. Anyway, listeners, I hope that you've enjoyed our discussion of Sphere by Michael Crichton. And, yeah, tune in next time for The Sympathizer, our talk about The Sympathizer. Hopefully that'll be good. Until then, peace out, listeners.
See you, everyone.
See you, everybody.